Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 173 of CJ Evolution, that's Criminal Justice Evolution. Pat Fitzgibbons here, host and creator of the show. Whatever you were doing, wherever you were at, thank you for spending a little bit of your valuable time with me. Special thanks to the brave men and women who serve in the criminal justice profession. You do a very hard and difficult job. You have much support, though, so never stop believing that. And for all the people out there who are not part of the criminal justice family, thank you for listening to the show. We hope you are enjoying the great guest we have on. We got another great one coming on in a few minutes, and the other content that we provide. So thank you so much for the support. You know, leadership goes without saying. It is so important in law enforcement. That's why I'm so excited to have Major Charles Chip Huth, who has 26 years of law enforcement experience with the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. This guy is amazing. He's led the SCU Tactical Enforcement Team, their SWAT team, for about a decade and has planned, coordinated, and executed over 2,500 high-risk tactical operations. He is a licensed National Defensive Tactics Trainer, a court-certified police practices expert, and the state of Missouri's Defensive Tactics Subject Matter Expert. He's also a senior consultant for the Arbinger Institute, which he's going to talk about. He is an amazing man. He is doing great things for the criminal justice profession, helping groom and educate the next generation of law enforcement professionals. I give you the one, the only, Major Charles Chip Huth. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. So excited to have Major Charles Chip Huth, who is on the show right now. Chip is an amazing guy. He's 26 years of law enforcement experience and serves as the commander of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department's North Patrol Division. We're going to talk about leadership, what he thinks some of the challenges are in law enforcement. I'm just honored to have Chip on the show. Welcome, Chip.
Hey, thanks a lot. I really appreciate you having me back.
Well, you're just an amazing guy. You got a lot of great things in your background. You're out there leading. Did I miss anything in the bio, Chip? I mean, you got an amazing background.
Well, probably the most important thing I'd say is that I'm married to an absolute wonderful woman who,
of course,
you know, just beyond amazing. Mm-hmm. And if it weren't for her and the support she gives me, there's just no way I'd be able to dedicate my what I would call extra time to doing the things that I get to do in the leadership space. And so mm-hmm. I just want to, you know, again, Shelley, if you ever hear this, you know how much I love you, but she's definitely the reason that I'm able to accomplish as much as I have.
And that's such a great point, Chip, and you know this, and hopefully people out there listening. You know, we would not be in the positions we are at. You're very successful in what you do if it wasn't for success at home with your family. That is so important. We live and work in a profession, Chip, you know, where, you know, the officers are officers, and they have problems in their personal life just like anybody does. And sometimes that, you know, that it affects their work performance, and it's so important that you have those good positive relationships at home. And I'm with you, Chip. My wife is everything to me, and she's my rock.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, and I think it's also germane to our conversation about leadership, because mm-hmm. obviously we lead not only at work but at home, and certainly sometimes you're leading up when you've got a wife of the caliber that I have. I mean, mm-hmm. she's amazing, but I've destroyed a couple marriages, Pat, before mm-hmm. this. I was awful in my marriages, and not in a classically abusive way, just in the passive, mm-hmm. you know, disconnected way. And so I guess the point I would make about that, and it's so relative to police, you know, because if you're not right at home, it's really hard to get right at work. Mm-hmm. And you carry that stress over. And of course, if you're distracted at work, you know, there's no telling that could be tragic. And, mm-hmm. and so I would just say, look, these things that we're talking about, these things you and I are talking about relative to our spouses and our home life, these are hard-won lessons. These aren't things that, like, you know, generally, I don't know your background, but I can tell you I made a lot of mistakes.
Oh, me too. Me too. Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. So, and the important thing is you learn from the mistakes. You know that, Chip. And I'm like you. I mean, I have an ex-wife that was, you know, when I was coming up in law enforcement, and kind of the same thing, you know, she had to go through a lot, and I was in the military, and she had to deal with a lot. And mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, you learn from your mistake. Not that my
you know, first marriage was a huge mistake. It's just that you learn, at least I learned, okay, what do I need to do better to make myself a better husband, to make myself a better parent, you know, and that's all part of it. And unfortunately, some people don't learn from it. But yeah, you're right. It's so essential to leadership. Yeah. What made you get into law enforcement, sir? I mean, I know that's a basic question, but I'm always interested in, you know, what was the catalyst? What was the thing that made you get in there?
Yeah, well, so my story might be a little bit different than some, and I really enjoy, it's really unique when you talk to police officers and ask that question. So I'm fascinated by the fact you ask it. I mean, it's really, well, it can be very instructive, you know, the answers. Mm-hmm. And so, well, my background is really eclectic, and I will tell you that as a child, I ended up for some time being homeless and abused. My father was a career criminal and a bit psychopathic, and my mother was, she suffered from bipolar and schizophrenia, and my dad was very abusive, and he would travel, take us around the country, mostly in the eastern part of the country, and and he'd just commit crimes and cons and things like that, and he'd drag us along, and then, you know, he'd had his fill of a place, he'd leave us, and he'd disappear off to where we later found out was another family that he maintained. Actually, he was married to another woman with other kids and in Ohio, and he'd leave us for a bit, and then we'd end up, you know, predictably living in a car or, you know, that type of thing until the police would find us and scoop us up, and we'd end up at a Salvation Army, and we were fostered off and on in different homes and those type of things. And so my brother and sister and I, we came to associate the police with safety. Mm-hmm. We felt unsafe if it was my dad putting a lot of marks on us and the police would come, or if it was us in a car and the police would find us there on the street collecting cans or cardboard out of trash cans and they would find us. And our interactions with the police were so positive. Mm-hmm. We began to associate them with safety. When they were around, we felt safe. And as we got older and we were rescued out of that situation by an uncle and taken off to live in a rural area in Missouri, we just never forgot those lessons. And so not only did I become a police officer, but every one of my siblings became police officers.
Wow.
And we felt like, and still feel like, I like to think, that we can provide some of that same feeling of security to people who are struggling. Mm-hmm. And so that's my answer to that.
Wow. Well, thank you for your service, sir. And I know you're an Army veteran, so thank you for your service, both in the military and in law enforcement.
Thank you for yours, Pat. I'm aware of your service in the 82nd as well.
Thank you. Now, I saw an amazing, you know, 2015 WinX talk where you spoke about the mindset of policing. Now, on its surface, it might seem, okay, basic, but can you talk about that? And more importantly, how do you get officers? Well, I'll let you talk about that first, and then I'll have a follow-up question.
Well, I think the point I was trying to make in the WinX talk, and it's based a lot on, primarily on the work of the Arbinger Institute, which is a company that I partner with. I'm a member of the Arbinger consulting team. And the thing I liked about Arbinger and the thing I struggled to get across in the talk is they developed a language that equipped people to talk about something that is very complex and dense, but they equipped us to talk about it in a way that's pretty simplistic. And so what I was trying to get across in the talk, what I'm really talking about is self-deception. Mm-hmm. This idea that you can hold two different concepts that conflict in your mind at the same time and be totally unaware of the conflict. And it's really unique to humans, you know, this, our ability to do this. It's like, I have this sense that I should do something to be helpful to you, but I don't. And then when I don't, I have to have justification for not doing that. And this process is just, right? And this process is iterative. It goes on and on and on throughout my day. And so when I'm talking about mindset in the WinX talk, what I'm talking about is not what we do as leaders, but how we see. Because how we see influences what we do. And so this idea in law enforcement that's been around for a long, long time, at least for my whole career, is that we train officers on the behaviors we want them to engage in, and we give them all these tactical tools and behavioral prescriptions, but we don't talk to them about the way they see themselves in relation to the job and the mission and the objective. And so so when we talk about mindset, that's what we're talking about. How do you see yourself in relation to others? Mm-hmm. You know, are you, you know, and you've got all these terms that people don't are uncomfortable with, and some they prefer, whether it be warrior or guardian or, you know, all you've got public servant and these type of things. How do I conceptualize myself in this role? Because that is going to determine in large part how I'm perceived. And because people don't respond to what you do as much as to who you are being while you're doing it. And so that was what I was trying to get out in that short talk, was that that idea that we need to really focus on that deeper level.
Yeah.
Behavior drives results, mm-hmm. but mindset drives behavior.
That's such a good point. And I read you said something that really kind of, it just hit me, that you wrote a great article, again, Public Trust and the Warrior Ethos, on September 27, 2016. I read it. It's another, just a great piece where you talked about that. Where you talked about this instructor who got up there, and you even said, Chip, that you didn't think he was doing it in kind of a malicious or demeaning way, but he said law enforcement, it's a law enforcement room filled with law enforcement professionals, and he said, you're simply a better class of people. And I love the article you wrote, because I agree with you, where we have this sheepdog, you know, mentality where, you know, we have to protect them, and that's partly true, but, you know, people are helpless without us.
Yeah. Well, I think that sentiment ignores a fundamental truth about people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that if you believe that's reality, then you're operating in a virtual reality. It only really exists in your head.
Yeah.
I caught a lot of flack, by the way. Oh, that article was funny. That's what happens when you write an article at 2 a.m. after.
You hit it on the head.
Well, I was actually taking on a pretty much what's become a sacred cow in law enforcement with this ideas, this ideology. And I'm not for ideologies. Mm-hmm. You know, I you could be extreme one way or the other, and you're really gonna get it wrong. I'm for trying to tell the truth and tell the truth about who we are and what we're doing. And I just think taking that article took on a lot of things that people, you know, look, it's like this. I have this discussion all the time. You know, I've had young troopers come in and say, hey, you know what, you need to do this, this, and this, because officer safety is the most important thing. And so to that, I say a couple of things. The first thing I say is, well, officer safety isn't the most important thing. If it were, we wouldn't do dangerous things. When people called 911 and said, I'm going to have a robbery at the 7-Eleven, we'd say, well, call us when they leave. And we'll come take a report, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, from all the things you've done in your career and all the things you've sent other officers to do as a commander, you know that officer safety takes a backseat to the safety of the people we serve, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we know that, like, as we talk about it. But so I say that, of course, but then that doesn't always ring well. And so they preach about how important officer safety is and this, that, and the other. And, of course, then I say, well, look, if officer safety is that important, you know, when's the last time you've been to the range? Why are you 50 pounds overweight? You know, why aren't you wearing your body armor? Mm. You know, like if officer safety is really that important, then we got to start here. Once we crawl, we can walk, right? Mm-hmm. Then we'll start with these high level recipes. So I think part of that warrior ethos idea, and by the way, I guess the article might lend itself, like some people might think I'm against that type of thing, and I'm not. The caution is, think deeply about the metaphors you use and the implications of those metaphors. I don't know what the right metaphors are. Mm. I'm just saying that they have implications when you think about them. And I think people feel like these tattoos, and again, not anti-tattoo by any means, but these tattoos people get and these titles they carry around, I think it can become like a security blanket for some people where they feel tough and capable, and that then relieves them of the responsibility of actually doing the hard work of preparing to be tough and capable, you know, which can be quite arduous. So that's a lot. But
and how do you get, because I know you talk about, you know, inward and outward mindset, we hit on it just recently, but so how do you train? I'm sure you get this question a lot, but you know, you get that young trooper who comes in your office, and you know, I mean, imagine some of it comes with, you know, maturity and, you know, growth within the profession, but how do you get them to operate, like you said, from an outward mindset? I mean, not all the time, but think about the community and think about more and think about this and reaction, you know, action means reaction. And you know, this is going to happen if you do that. You know what I mean? I mean, how do you change that mentality? I mean, I know it's you know, it's the million dollar question. You can't control people. And I get that. But yeah, it just goes into, you know, there's something out there bigger than ourselves. Right. You know, and that's part of leadership. And, you know, I just, it's a million dollar question.
Well, it is, and I would say a couple of things. I would say, I would say more than we have time to say, but I will say it's a natural process. It's like part of my adolescence was spent on the farm, and, you know, on the farm, farms are governed by natural processes. You plant a crop, and you have to nurture it, and you have to tend to it, and then it grows, and then once it grows, you can harvest it, and there's no rushing that process. Like, I don't care how bad you want the corn to grow. It's going to grow at its own pace. And it's the same way with influencing people. We really have to understand that we got to be in it for the long haul. And it starts with, and this sounds trite, but I'm telling you, if you find something that works better, let me know. It starts with behavior modeling. And I make it a point to be on the weight pile between 5 and 5:30 every morning. And I'm at my unit on the weight pile, and everybody sees me on the weight pile every day. And so then they think, what? Well, fitness is important to him. I don't have to say anything. I don't have to walk around saying, hey, you need to be
in
shape.
You're modeling.
That's it.
Yeah.
You're showing them that you're willing to do the things that you would invite them to do. I wear my vest to work. Now, we're not required to by policy, but I wear it every day. I wear it when I'm at meetings, at my desk. I'm certainly not out there doing the things that the troops are doing at that level anymore. But I do it because I want them to know it's important. And as a consequence, every single one of them buys in and does that. All right. So now look, and I'm not the first one to think of this. I learned this from people smarter than me, but I mean, that's where it starts. And then the other thing, and the reason I promoted, because I was in SWAT. So for 22 and a half years, I kicked doors and I thought I was going to retire doing that. And the reason I promoted was because a corporate client asked me a question, and my spontaneous answer to that question made me realize that I had to put my money where my mouth was. And the question they asked me was, they said, Chip, what do you think the biggest problem facing law enforcement today is? And I did not miss a beat. I said, the biggest problem facing law enforcement today is a leadership vacuum. We have leaders that are treating their people in a way that is antithetical to the way they want their people to respond to the community. I said, and as long as people come to work and feel objectified and put upon, they are not going to be able to go out into the community and perform a dangerous function with an outward mindset. They're going to be defensive. They're going to be distrusting. And they're going to circle the wagons. So they've got it coming from both sides. They've got the unknown of the street, and then they've got the mercurial nature of their boss, right?
Sure.
Or, you know, the fact that there's inconsistency at work about the way discipline is meted out, or the way policies are enforced, or the way people are encouraged, right? So when I said that, I was like, yeah, okay, now I'm a practicing stoic. I've got to do something. I can't just complain about the other leaders that aren't doing the right thing.
Oh, yeah.
So that's part of it, big time. The modeling's huge, but look, we have got to do it inside our organizations. You know, we put a lot of focus on the community. Okay, well, look, I agree with that. I just don't think that the community and the police are different things. I think we're part of the community. And we've got to be able to take care of our police officers in the way we want them to take care of our other community members. That's the, in my mind, that's the, I guess you'd call it the secret sauce.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's just there's no easy path to that. It takes a lot of work, and you've got to honor the fact that it's I guess the principle would be that slow is fast with people, and fast is slow with people. There's two things cops don't like, and only two: the way things are and change.
Exactly right. And I'm glad you talked about that, Chip, because I was going to ask you what you think some of the biggest challenges in law enforcement. And I agree with you. You know, the leadership vacuum. What do you think? Or what are some of the qualities to success? You're very successful in what you do. What do you think some of the qualities, or what do you think some of the traits of good success are?
Well, it's funny. I had this discussion with a commander I just onboarded here, a captain, and I was kind of sharing with him a little bit of my philosophy. I'm very employee-centric, so that could be, well, it's a little bit different than probably the mainstream still yet today, I think. And so I was sharing some stuff with him, and he asked me, you know, that kind of question. I said, look, I've only got one, in my mind, one true valuable trait, and I have it, and it's this: I have an eye for talent. I know how to assemble a team. And so I will tell you, the key to success is putting the right people around you and making sure that you are precise in your language and that you communicate your vision and that they understand the strategy. They get the why. And if you can do that and you got the right people around you, look out, man. I mean, you just unleash that talent. you empower them to execute. I have a friend of mine that co-authored a book with General McChrystal, and I think the way that that Chris says it is that we want to maintain the bureaucratic hierarchy for practical purposes, but we want to push the decision-making to the edges of the organization mm-hmm. so that we're empowering these folks around us to make decisions. Mm-hmm. And the reason that that's important, and I think Chris and the General make a good point in their books, is that we live in a complex environment now. It's no longer just complicated. It's complex, and it's full of nonlinear escalation. So mm-hmm. we're to the point now where every single contact you have with every single person is significant beyond your ability to appreciate that significance. Yeah. So that, to me, like, I try to focus each day. And by the way, I think I'm probably, if I'm honest with you, and I have no reason not to be, as much as I'm flattered to be interviewed by you and to be considered to be a change leader, but I'm probably operating at 50% capacity, man. Like, there's so much more I could be doing, you know, like, I've got so far to go, it's not even funny, but
yeah.
But I really think that by valuing the importance of every contact with internal and external customers, that's the key, man. There's exponential benefit to that.
Of course.
And so that's okay.
Yeah, and I like what you say about, you know, I mean, just surrounding yourself. Look, you're the average of what, the five people you surround yourself with? And I don't No, I'm serious. And you don't I don't want to be, I don't know about you, Chip, but I think, you know, we're alike in some ways. I don't want to be the smartest guy in the room. No. I want to surround myself with people who are smarter than me, because that's how I learn. Yeah. That's how I become better.
Well, if you're the smartest guy in the room, Pat, you're in the wrong room.
Exactly. Exactly.
There's no doubt about that. I mean, you look, but that comes from a place of deep personal security, mm-hmm. and you have to work to get there.
Exactly.
You know? Like, you have to work to get there really hard. If you're carrying around a self-justifying image of yourself as a great leader who knows everything, anybody that has an idea that threatens that image is going to cause you to react defensively and shut you down.
Exactly.
And it's going to invite you to go inward.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about the outward mindset. The inward mindset is kind of a default way of dealing with the world. I think evolution has kind of optimized us for thinking that way, like me first, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, evolution didn't optimize us for complex leadership challenges. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when we go inward, all that means is that we're exclusively self-focused on the things that we need to do to the exclusion of the impact we have on others. And I think that's a natural default state for us as human beings, and we have to constantly fight through it. And, you know, going back to the farm metaphor, you know, what do you have to do to get weeds in your garden? You know, nothing, you know,
exactly.
Like they're just going to happen. Right. So we have to constantly, you and I as leaders, prune that garden and constantly be looking for those things that are inviting us to go inward.
And the one thing that, and you've seen this, the one thing I don't understand, I work with a lot of humble officers, but why is humility so elusive sometimes? I imagine you're a pretty humble guy. I mean, you wouldn't be where you're at unless you were. And humility is so important in law enforcement. I've seen people in, you know, military and different organizations I work for that they can never say that they're wrong.
Mm.
You know, you know what I mean? I mean, I know you've seen it too. And I think humility is another, just so much of a big part among many other things. And you hit on a big one, but it's so important to leadership, I think.
Oh, it's like a superpower, man. Mm. I mean, but here's the thing: I haven't always been that way. I was
neither have I.
Yeah,
and it's
I was very
thing.
Insecure. This is what I think, honestly, Pat. And if you got two choices, you can decide to be humble, or you can wait for the world to humble you. One of those two things are going to happen, man. You're going to be put in a situation that, you know, it might be a tactical scenario where there's four or five right decisions that could be made, but you realize in that critical moment with split seconds to spare that you're not smart enough to make any of them. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can either decide to be humble up front, or you're going to get humbled. But it's very difficult to do, again, if I have this image of myself, if I see myself as this tough guy, then I'm focusing on myself and my image. I can't focus on the mission. I have to choose between focusing on self or the results. I can't do both. And the humility piece is really, really important. But, you know, it's also something that people sound, well, that sounds soft to me. Well, look, what it really is, what humility really is radical self-awareness. Mm-hmm. It's just being totally honest and telling the truth about yourself your capabilities, your potential, your the fact that we're inextricably connected. We're inextricably connected to all of the people that are around us in the, you know, trying to accomplish the mission. That's what it is, you know, being able to just be honest with yourself. And I mean, my God, I think sometimes we get through life by not being honest with ourselves. You know, we tell ourselves that, you know, that extra cheeseburger won't hurt, or, you know, I can skip working out today. I'll just double up tomorrow. I mean, we lie to ourselves all the time. Right. I don't have to. You know what? I know my wife's in there doing the dishes right now after cooking a great meal and helping me out. But you know what? I'm going to pretend like I don't hear that going on so I can finish watching what I'm doing or watching the show. I mean, we do it all the time. And so humility, I don't know if there's anything that you could tell me that you could bring up, any virtue that would be more critical than that, but also more elusive.
I agree. I want to shift a little bit, shift gears, and I want you to talk a little bit about the Arbinger Institute that you're involved in, Chip.
Yeah, so Arbinger saved my life, man. So the reason I'm involved and became part of that team is they just, man, they rescued me from a place. Their philosophy rescued me from a place where it was dark. It was heading in a bad direction. I mean, I was on the verge of my second divorce, which ended up actually, I ended up actually getting divorced from my wife, even though I was exposed to Arbinger. It was too little, too late. By the time I started to shift my mindset with her, she just, I've heard it said before, and I've said it many times. I think they attribute it to me now, but you can't talk your way out of a situation you behave your way into. And I mean, you know, and so it was really kind of tough. But the point was this: is that both of my marriages, I was married to two completely different women who were wonderful women, but they were completely different in every possible way. And I blame both of them for my marriage's failing.
Wow.
And as I'm sitting around thinking about it after I got exposed to Arbinger, I realized I was the common denominator.
Right.
Like I was the one thing that was constant in both those three, the only thing that was constant in both those marriages. And so you talk about an awakening of sorts. So I became part of the Arbinger team. And the Arbinger Institute is an international consultancy. They work a lot in the corporate, military, law enforcement space. And basically what we do is we go in and try to help people get results by changing the way they see the mission, each other, the way they collaborate. We teach them to consider the impact of the work they do on others. And we teach them to structure their objectives in a way that supports what other people in the team are trying to accomplish. And beyond that, Arbinger does a lot of work in the counseling space, you know, be it marriage counseling, be it, you know, psychological services, a lot of not-for-profit work. It's really interconnected into so many things. But it's just a wonderful, I'm getting ready to head out to actually an agency in your state on Monday and Tuesday. And my co-author and I, Jack, are going to do a 2-day workshop with that agency.
We're going to try to help them
develop and implement this outward mindset model. So that's a little bit about Arbinger. Again, I could go on all day. I'm a big, big fan. Like I said, my relationship today with my wife, today with my adult sons, which though that relationship was tanked at its worst, is so strong and so powerful that if I were to keep talking about it, I'd probably be crying.
Well, good for you, Chip. That's where I'm at
with Arbinger. Yeah. You wondered.
Now, how do they find Arbinger? People out there listening, they want to find it. What's the website or contact information?
Yeah, www.arbinger.com. It's like Harbinger without the H.
Okay.
So, you go on the website, it'll have, videos and links and texts and contacts. And, you know, like I said, I think we're in 22 countries now. So it's all amazing. Over. And it is good stuff, man. Life changing.
I want to talk about your book really quick, Unleashing the Power of Conditional Respect, which is available on Amazon, everybody. I haven't got the book. I'm going to get it, but can you talk about it for a minute or two?
Boy, I can. One thing I can say is, you know, it's Jack and I, we worked pretty hard on that book, but man, we didn't know what we were doing. And I will tell you that we just, you write a book and you're like, oh, I wish I would have wrote this, or you learned something else. I wish I would have said this. So the book's coming up on I think we published it in 2010, so we wrote it in 2008, 2009, and it's a textbook. We thinned it down. We cut it by 2/3 to make it digestible, but it is a textbook, and it's written in that kind of format And it's marketed as a textbook, so it's not cheap. And people don't know this, and that they listen to this, they might know it. But a lot of times people ask me for a copy, and they don't know that I ordered off Amazon, that I signed it and I sent it to them. So I've spent I got a budget for buying my own book, because it's cheaper on Amazon than my publisher discount. But so good luck buying that. Make payments on it. That's what I do. But the book is interesting. So Jack and I were talking about this idea that we understand respect as a currency. That's typically how we look at it, and that's an important thing. We're not saying you should respect everyone's choices. There certainly are people that make choices that are immoral. There are things that we have to be able to judge in order to lead a principled life, right? So we're not saying I should just respect you because you exist. That's not what we're saying. We're saying that we should have unconditional respect for your humanity, meaning that I have to acknowledge that no matter what you're doing, bad or good, you're a person who has hopes, needs, dreams, fears, things that motivate you. And by understanding what we call a core truth, we can make better decisions. If I'm making decisions seeing you as an object, something that's in my way or something that I can be manipulated to my benefit, then I'm not making decisions that are based in reality, right? Mm-hmm. And so this idea of unconditional respect is, it's respect for your humanity, not predicated on anything you do or don't do. And it does manifest itself in behaviors. For instance, with my team, with my SWAT team, is where a lot of this philosophy was tested in a real pressure cooker, a high-risk SWAT team kicking in hundreds of doors a year, getting shootings, all kinds of stuff happening with that team. I led that team for over a decade, so this wasn't tested. This isn't a mamby-pamby, hug-a-thug type concept, right? And so, it manifests, sure. We used to go into the search warrants and we kick in the door and, you know what that looks like. And then, we would just we never came down off that tactical, the way we were operating. We were the philosophy was close distance, apply force. And that's the way we dealt with people. And the shift I saw in the team was amazing because the team started, okay, everything's clear, everybody's secured. They started talking to people, getting car seats for kids, calling people to come. I've seen them change diapers and make baby bottles, all kinds of stuff that you could never train them to do, right?
Yeah.
This unconditional respect idea kind of lays right in with the outward mindset. The outward mindset's kind of foundational to it. And then the unconditional respect piece is kind of what you can see.
Yeah.
What are these guys – what are they doing that's different? It feels different. What are they doing that's different?
Yeah. I remember you were talking about that. It made me think about you changing diapers. You were telling I believe it was in your WinX talk where you were talking about this, a guy on point on your SWAT team that went in and you were looking for him and you didn't know where he was at. And you went into the kitchen and this big, huge SWAT guy, people in law enforcement, these guys are huge and they have to be. Most of them, and you go in there, and he's making bottles for the kids, and that really kind of de-escalated thing. It was a tense situation. Then he went in there and he started handing out bottles to these kids. You guys just kicked in a door, and then wow, you guys kind of de-escalated everything, and everything was great. Or not great, but you kind of de-escalated that because of that simple act, and that is amazing.
Yeah, well, the thing is, and the point we make about it, actually, that story is captured in the first chapter of the Outward Mindset. So if you were to read the Outward Mindset, you would get that story. Yeah. And I'm telling you, the thing that makes the difference is this. I could have not stood in front of a room of SWAT guys and told them to make baby bottles. They would have laughed me out of the room, right?
Exactly.
And it's not that they wouldn't do it as people. They're people too, right? They've got kids, a lot of them. It's that it never would have crossed their minds to do something like that. That wouldn't be something on their radar, right? But because of that mindset shift and that commitment to unconditional respect, this is something just spontaneously that this officer felt he should do, and he just honored that sense of what he should do.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about this all the time. We are always when we're interacting with people, we're always given opportunities to this sense arises in us that we should maybe there's something we could do for them, and we either honor that sense or we sell out and don't honor it. And have to justify not doing it. And if you don't do the first thing, you're going to do the second. And the example, one of the examples I often use is, you're waiting on an elevator, doors are going to close, you see somebody coming, running, and you get the sense, man, I should catch the door for them. And of course, if you do, all's right with the world, right? But if you don't, if you let the door close, Listen to the things you say to yourself as you're going up in that elevator to make that okay, right?
Yeah, you're justifying it.
You're justifying it. You're making all justification is putting pressure on something to make it straight. That's what it is in construction. You justify crooked walls. Well, we justify crooked behavior.
It's amazing. Well, Chip, how can if people want to reach out to you, sir, how can they find you?
Gosh, so I'm on the Twitter. I'm not supposed to say the. My assistant.
You're on Twitter.
My assistant's going to be so mad at me. They make fun of me all the time. I'm watching the Netflix. I'm on the Twitter. So yeah, I'm on Twitter. I don't have a huge presence on Twitter. Not like Lou Hayes, by the way. If Lou hears this, he's a tweeting fool, man. He's got all kinds of smart things to say too. My buddy Jocko, same thing, all over the Twitter. Jocko Willink.
Oh,
yes. What man? We could have a podcast talking about Jocko, couldn't we?
Oh yeah,
He's an amazing guy.
Yeah.
But I do have a presence there on Twitter, and then on LinkedIn, I've got a significant amount of followers on there, and I do check LinkedIn daily, I think at least daily, and of course my email address. Should I give that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, is that I get a lot, so but I respond to them all. It's Charles Charles. Huth, H-U-T-H, at kcpd.org, O-R-G. And that's my main email address that I'm attached to. And I just try, look, if I can be helpful, I will. If I can connect you with somebody smarter than me, chances are good that can happen. I will. I return all my calls and emails, even if it takes a little bit of time. And it just gives me a lot of, well, it's almost like I'm paying my penance, man, for being such a crappy leader when I was younger.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to be helpful now. So,
well, you're doing a great job, sir, and thank you for your continued service. Mentoring and guiding, these up and coming generation. You are doing a great job. Please stay safe out there, and thank you for coming on, sir. I sure do appreciate it. I know you're a busy man, but keep doing great and amazing things.
Patrick, I really appreciate you again. Thank you for your service, and to all your listeners, thank you for everything that you do. And no service is insignificant; it's all important. So, thank you all.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.